Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
This morning we're going to start the Gospel of John. Turn to the very end of the Gospel of John. That was quick, wasn't it? I am. When I want to get through something. So let me tell you a little background on my particular fondness for this book and its influence over the course of my Christian life. Most of you know that I grew up in the Lutheran Church. I was a good little Lutheran boy. I was an acolyte in the Lutheran Church. It meant that I got to wear a robe and light and put out candles. I had responsibility. In the Lutheran Church that I went to, in the particular synod I was a part of, when kids turn 11 and 12, they start catechism class. And during catechism class, you learn the basics of the Bible, and you learn a whole lot about Lutheranism. And then once you have graduated from catechism class, you get to take your first communion. That's the goal of it. So that from that point forward, you are part of the confessing Lutheran Christian body, so that once a month when they have communion, you can participate. It is the equivalent, it's the Lutheran equivalent of what my Jewish friends were going through at the same time. Because right around the same time, my Jewish friends were starting Hebrew class. And then after a couple of years in Hebrew class, when the boys turned 13, they got a bar mitzvah. And they got money, and they got TVs, and they got games, and they got a big party. And usually there was some kind of a dance with a band, with balloons and streamers and congratulations, and relatives came in from everywhere. I got First Communion. It just didn't seem equitable.
I won't be Jewish now.
And that does have a connection. The reason I bring it up is that that is a direct connection where New Covenant, New Testament churches tried to find some way to recognize the manhood or the growth of the individual person into manhood, because that was a Jewish tradition. I went through the Lutheran version of it. Well, by the time I was 16, 17, my head exploded, and suddenly I had lots of hair and a big beard, and everything I wore used to be on a cow. It was all leather and suede and, you know. And I was becoming this little jazz rock drum maniac. And the Lutherans didn't like that look. The Lutherans were not big on that appearance. And I, at the time, had begun teaching catechism class. I was teaching Sunday school for youth. They assigned my class to the choir room so that every time I was teaching a class, people could arbitrarily come in and check the robes, which basically meant go see what the long hair boy is doing. And so people would come in ostensibly to check the robes while they were paying attention to see if I was sticking to the lesson plan. Well, eventually the Lutherans and I had a parting of the ways. And it was really emotional, really difficult for me, because I thought that when I left the Lutheran Church that I was leaving God, that I was leaving religion at large, that I was leaving my relationship with God, and certainly that was the sort of pressure that was put on me when I opted to leave the church. How can you leave the church? You were catechized in this church. You took your communion in this church. You've served in this church. And so I left. And for the next few years, basically sold my soul to rock and roll, and that takes me to like my middle 20s. I moved to California. I had a successful music career going. And God had a girl cross my path named Linda Anderson, never forgot her name, who was a TBN-ish Christian, she and her mom both. It was the two of them, the two women, Linda and her mom, living in a house together. Linda's dad had passed away, and they define their life around their TBN-style Christianity. But they were also really nice to starving musicians like me. when I first got out there to Los Angeles, they kind of took me in the way people would take in a puppy or a stray cat. And so they would invite me over and feed me. They gave me furniture. I mean, they were just really nice to me. And one night, Linda asked me, "Do you have a Bible?" And I said, no, I don't. Bible? No, I don't have a Bible. And she gave me a Bible, a New International Version. She gave me an NIV Bible. And I took it back to my apartment in North Hollywood, and I put it among the other collectible things in my closet. And it just kind of stayed there. Well, during that period of my life, I went through a lot of very esoteric things, stuff that I really don't discuss or talk about much anymore because it plants all kinds of crazy ideas in people's heads. But I was way out on the fringe during those days and studying a lot of really new agey, esoteric things. Because I had left Christianity behind, so I was chasing anything else that might have something to do with spirituality, because I couldn't get away from the notion that God still existed somehow, somewhere. And I just always assumed that if he did exist, he probably liked me, because I was a likable, long-haired, sinner, depraved rock and roll guy. But he must really like me, so I, you know. Because God must like everybody. That was my feeling at the time. So I was reading and really getting into a really extreme esoteric thing that I'm not going to go into that convinced me that there is more to human life than just flesh and blood. I became convinced that there is a spiritual element to human life. And yet, as I talked to people about it, nobody seemed to know anything. You could talk to my friends who at the time were musicians and actors and writers and artsy people, and you would say, but what about when you die? What about forever? What about the spiritual aspect of life? And nobody knew anything. So I started finding more books about spiritual. I read the Bhagavad Gita. Anybody read that? There's a tough read, huh? And I was looking for anything that would give me a leg up on eternity, on spiritual things. Nothing. I read big portions of the Quran, and I learned how to and do this, and I learned history, and I learned rules, and I learned all that. But nobody was saying, look, let me tell you about forever. So I got my Bible out, went and got that dusty old NIV out one night in my apartment in North Hollywood, and decided maybe something in here can tell me something about the reality of forever. And so I opened to the book of John. And I read that from the formation of the world, from before anything was ever made, Christ was with God. And I went, oh, now we're talking. Now we're talking about the kind of stuff I want to know about. And throughout the book of John, Jesus is walking around talking about life eternal. And he's talking about heaven. And he talks about heaven with the kind of familiarity that I would talk about my living room. I know the furniture in my living room, and that's the familiarity he had with heaven. I was thrilled. I was like, oh, here's somebody who knows something. Here's somebody who's been there. Here's somebody who's been to heaven, comes to tell us what it's like, and is going back to heaven. Well, what surprised me was that in all my study of all these different things and all these different books and digging, it was all information. And I got toward the end of the book of John where Jesus tells his disciples, I'm going away, and where I'm going, you can't come. And I cried. And it surprised me. It surprised me that I cried, because nothing else I had read out of all these other esoteric books and religious and spiritual books, nothing else had ever struck me that way, where it got past my intellect and hit my heart. And I realized that whoever this Jesus guy was, I missed him. And that really surprised me, because I wasn't even sure yet who he was. Well, that scared me. So I closed that Bible, and it went back into the closet for a while. So leap forward a couple of years. I was in San Francisco. At the time, I had an apartment in San Francisco, and I had an apartment in North Hollywood, and I was bouncing back and forth between the record plant in Los Angeles, the record plant in Sausalito. And in the middle of the night, one night, Easter 1981, I was in my apartment in San Francisco, and there was this preacher on the television who I had seen before and had made fun of and had laughed at, and ha, 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 what a joker. And he was standing in front of his congregation beginning a lecture on the proof of the resurrection. And I sat down, this had to be 2 a.m, sat down and listened to him. All right, prove it to me, buddy. All right, show me your stuff. Bring out your gun. Show me that the resurrection's real. And the way he approached it, he didn't say, I'm asking you to accept anything on faith. I'm not asking you to just accept something because I say it. I want you to take a hard-headed look at the evidence and see what kind of conclusion you come to. And he got done presenting his evidence, and I sat there going, oh my goodness, he's right. There's no other conclusion you can come to historically, factually, than that Jesus actually did come out of the grave. Nothing else explains all of the facts and the details that surround his resurrection. And so I became convinced that the resurrection was true. And that man looked in the camera and said, now settle it. And I, not being a Christian, not having any Christianese to work with, not knowing any Christian language to work with, walked out into the garden in front of my apartment, looked up at the black sky and said, okay, checkmate. You win. And I broke out my NIV. I said, okay, what happened after he went away? And read the rest of the book of John. And that was a critical turning point in my life, because from that moment forward, God owned me and he became the primary factor in my life. And at the exact same moment, my quite successful music career went straight into the tank. I mean, my music career came undone, rather like there was a sovereign God in heaven saying, okay, Mr. Rock and Roll Boy, you want to see checkmate? Here we go. Little did I know or expect or would have ever believed that later in life, I would be the guy standing up in front of people saying, trust me, believe me on this one. It's all real, it's all true, and it can be proven. And now here I stand, because he is actually that sovereign. So the book of John has had a profound influence on my life, on my Christianity, on my thinking. A couple times in my life, in different teaching environments, I've begun teaching the book of John verse by verse. I don't believe I ever got through it all the way. This time, we're going to get through it all the way. Now, we may be in the book of John till Jesus comes. That's what you're thinking. They're already starting the pool up here. The betting pool has begun.
He says 2011.
2011's not a bad bet, probably. So we're going to work our way through the book of John. The book of John, unlike the synoptic gospels, the other three, has a tremendous amount of theology and doctrine built into it. It's not just narrative. John also gives you a lot of theological statements that you have to deal with. Like, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's not narrative, that's a statement, that's a declaration. He opens his gospel with that. Now, there's no question historically, or grammatically, academically, that John the Apostle wrote this gospel. We have a great deal of historic testimony to that fact. For instance, there is a fellow named Irenaeus, one of the church fathers. He lived during the second century, which means during the 100s AD. And he writes that he was told by Polycarp that this book came from John. Now, how does Polycarp know that? Polycarp was born right around 70 AD, and so he would have been in his 20s and 30s toward the end of the Apostle John's life, and he was a student of the Apostle John. So he got it from the Apostle John that this gospel was written by the Apostle John, that the book of Revelation was written while John was on Patmos, and that John 1, 2, and 3, the short epistles, come right from the pen of that apostle. So we have it on very good historic testimony and veracity that it is actually the man who walked and talked with Jesus who wrote this book. Now, there's some discussion about when he wrote it. According to Polycarp and Irenaeus, we know that John was on the Isle of Patmos right around 90 to 92 AD. And we know that because Polycarp tells us who the emperor was during the time that John was on the Isle of Patmos. So that narrows it down really well. The question becomes whether he wrote the Revelation and then his Gospel, or whether he wrote his Gospel and then later the Revelation. The common thinking is that during the time that John was the bishop of Ephesus, which would have been pre-70 AD, that he probably wrote his gospel during that period. He wrote his gospel while he was in Ephesus, then Rome, taking over Ephesus, banishes him to the Isle of Patmos, and while he's there, then it makes sense that the seven letters to the churches in Asia first go to Ephesus, and then that circular trade route of all the seven, the other six cities with churches that would have circled around to Ephesus. John is the perfect guy to write to those churches since he had been bishop in that area. They would have accepted his word, his letters from there. Now, John has a very distinct purpose in why he's writing. John assumes that his audience has read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or is familiar with one of them at very least. The synoptic gospels all cover essentially the same material. There's little variations here and there depending on the author and what he felt was important to emphasize to his audience. But John assumes you've read those. And the reason we know that John assumes it is that he doesn't include some of the material that's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but he references it as if you would know it. He doesn't talk about Jesus being baptized, but he does make reference to it. He doesn't tell you about John being beheaded, but he mentions in past tense, this was after John was beheaded. Like you would just know that already. So John assumes, writing later than the others, after the Pauline epistles, after the synoptic gospels, he assumes you already have a fair foundation in this Christian stuff. And so when he sits down to write, he has a very distinct purpose for adding his voice to the voices that already exist defending Christ and Christianity. Now, some of you who have been listening to our Wednesday night study know that when we talked about the tabernacle, we talked about the four colors that were used in the tabernacle and the four living beasts, and then we talked about how they coincide with the four gospels. Each of the four gospel writers is writing to a specific audience for a specific purpose. Let's see if you've learned anything. Who was Matthew writing to, and what was his purpose in writing?
He wrote to the Jews.
He was writing to a Jewish audience.
Jesus is Messiah.
Say it out loud. I can't hear you.
To tell them that Jesus was the Messiah.
Very good. Well done. Jesus is Messiah. That was his point. He quotes the Old Testament more than the other two synoptic gospels, and his purpose is to tell the Jews, Messiah has come, he's identifiable, he's Jesus of Nazareth. That's the point for which he wrote. Who was Mark writing to, and what was his purpose in writing?
Gentiles.
Writing to a Gentile audience, largely. What's his purpose?
Jesus' suffering servant.
Suffering servant, that Jesus has come to suffer and to die. This was a tough thing for the Jews to get a hold of, especially when you read Isaiah and you read about Messiah coming. There's this promise that he's coming, and they would all be going, yes, he's going to come, and he's going to establish the kingdom and the Abrahamic covenant. We're going to get the land, and David's going to return, and we're going to be ruling. And then Isaiah says that he's a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and then he's described as dying. Well, that's a really big problem for the Jews who are saying, no, Messiah doesn't die. Messiah comes and rules over Israel. That's his job. So that's what Mark is really explaining, that he is the suffering servant that Isaiah described, because not only did he come as Messiah, but he came and died as Messiah the servant, but he rose again, therefore he can return as Messiah the conquering king. Who was Luke writing to? Boy, you all ought to know this. Who was Luke writing to, and what was his purpose for writing?
Jesus is the perfect man.
Perfect man, exactly. Why was that important, that he would write about the perfect man?
He was writing to the Greeks.
He's writing to the Greeks. He's writing to a Gentile Greek audience. Now, of course, if you've looked at Greek culture, history, art, you see the constant representation of men in their perfect form. Certainly our Olympics come from Greece and are all designed to show how good men can be, how excellent men can be, how they can... And they worship men as gods, and gods as men, and the interaction between gods and men, and all of that. And so Jesus is represented in Luke's gospel as being the quintessential perfect man. So now you've got the Messiah, you've got the suffering servant Messiah who rises again, and you've got he's the perfect man. So the only thing missing out of those three is Jesus is God. And that's what John's all about. That's why John starts right out with what I've already quoted. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. One of the things that John had to deal with a lot and had to argue in his short epistles about is that as soon as Christianity got a foothold in the world, immediately there were folks who wanted to write other opinions about it. And one of the leading other opinions was something called Gnosticism. Gnosticism philosophically believed that everything that was fleshly was just bad, just intrinsically bad, and everything spiritual was good. And so the notion that God could have a son that could walk on the planet, well, then he couldn't possibly be physical. He couldn't be flesh, because if he was flesh, he couldn't be good, because flesh and physical things are bad. And so right away, as soon as Christianity started working its way through the Middle Eastern world, the Gnostics began writing their own competitive literature, explaining that Jesus was a phantom, he was a spirit. That's why he could be crucified and still be there. He was never physical. He didn't actually die. They take away the basis of the genuine death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. And so John has to compete with that. John has to say, now let me explain who Christ was. Yes, he was a man. He was fully a man. He was completely a man. But he is also God. He's God in the flesh. Now, of course, Matthew and Luke both include genealogies which prove that he is of the Davidic line, that he has the right to rule as Messiah, that he has the right to be king over Israel. And so Matthew traces him back through David to Abraham, so that he is the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. He's the son of David, and therefore rightfully the king and the Messiah. Luke, when he does his genealogy, traces him all the way back to Adam. Again, perfect man, showing that he's the second Adam, the perfect man. So John trumps them both and goes all the way back to, okay, in the beginning. Let's go all the way back there. Jesus does not start at Abraham. Jesus does not start at Adam. Jesus starts at in the beginning of everything. Before there was an anything, there was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, the word that he's using repeatedly there, the word that he uses there, and he's going to use it a lot, is a word we should all be familiar with. Logos, you know that word? It's translated word because the translators all struggle with it. What are they going to say about it? It's real hard, especially in formal equivalent translations, it's real hard to find an English word for that Greek word, because the Greek word has such a wide meaning and wide berth that it's tough to narrow it down to a single English word. And so we went with word. But what it really means is intelligence demonstrated by logical spoken words. That's the big picture. Intelligence demonstrated by, proven by, logical spoken words. So if I want to prove to you that I'm a thinking human being with a reasonable amount of intelligence, I'm going to try to speak in a logical, intelligent way. And that's the essence of this word logos. If I just string a bunch of nonsensical words together, I may know some words, but I'm not very intelligent, right? If I burst into the room and say, you know, toothbrush, fire, colander, whoop, whoop, you know, you're going to go, what? What? You're not going to know what to do. Do we duck? Do we run? Do we shoot him? What do we do? So the essence of logos is there is an intelligence to God. And the intelligence that has always been, that is the essence of God, is demonstrated by the fact that he speaks, and he speaks in meaningful, logical ways. And the essence of God speaking is wrapped up in the logos, Christ. And so Christ is the speaking agency for the Godhead, to put it another theological way. In other words, John is purposefully drawing a one-for-one comparison between the first of Moses' letters, what we call the book of Genesis, which starts with, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." John goes back and uses the same words, "in the beginning," which would cause any Jewish person to reach back to the very beginning of the book of Genesis, the beginning of Scripture. In the beginning, God did some things. He wants you to know that when God did those things, the Logos was right there. And not only that, the Logos was the agency that spoke, "Let there be light." Christ was actively involved in the making of everything. That's what John is trying to prove. Now, that's not a foreign thought to New Testament theology. Paul is going to pick up that idea in the Colossian letter. We've taught through the Colossian letter, so this should sound familiar. But listen to the particular language that Paul uses here, and then ask yourself, where would Paul have gotten these ideas, these notions? Writing to the Colossians in Colossians 1, starting at verse 9, "For this reason also, since the day we heard of it, we've not ceased to pray for you and ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding, so that you will walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, to please him in all respects, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, for the attaining of all steadfastness and patience, joyously giving thanks to the Lord who has qualified us to share in the inheritance of the saints in light." Hold on to that word light too. We're going to get back to that. "He has rescued us from the domain of darkness." Hold on to the darkness and light contrast. "And he has transferred us to the kingdom of his Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins." He, the Son, is the image of the invisible God. He is the firstborn of all creation. "For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things consist and are held together." Where would Paul get that kind of language? In Christ, everything was made. There's not anything that was made without him. It was all made by him, and it was all made, important word, for him. This is all about him. This is all about the exaltation of the triune God. God is in the enterprise of glorifying himself, and the way he's doing it is through his Son. So John starts right out with this unbelievably huge, magnificent concept that when God said, "Let there be light," it was Christ that was active in doing that. He's the Logos. He's the intelligent word. You got that? I mean, John's Christology is very high. John's notion of who Christ is and what Christ did puts Christ at the very top and center of absolutely everything, which is why I have said repeatedly that our preaching has to be Christological. It has to be Christocentric. It has to have Christ at the center of it, because that's where the New Testament writers keep putting him. And so if you start preaching about people and putting people at the center of Christianity, or the will of man or the decision of man, you put that at the center of Christianity, then you have to push Christ out of that central position that he absolutely must have. John places Christ right at the center of everything and says he was not only with God, but he is God and he made everything. Got that? Okay, now that was a whole lot of theology in one big fell swoop. Or one big swell foop, depending on how you want to.
What do you call, is there a word for the history of God?
Yeah, how do you do the history of God? I agree, yeah. The God of forever. Now let's write his history.
Yeah.
So all you can do is reach back to forever ago and say, in the beginning, there he was. And then he did everything. Now, that should solve a whole lot of both theological and emotional dilemmas for human beings. Because human beings torture themselves over questions like, why are we here? Human beings have constructed all kinds of philosophy. Greco-Roman philosophy still pervades our Western thinking. We are all Aristotelian at our core. We follow certain logical notions that we perceive to be true because that's what philosophy would say. And one of the big philosophical questions of life is, okay, why? Why are we here? What's the point? Why are there humans? Why is there a planet? Why is there sin? Why is there death? Why does anything exist? Why do people show up, live for a while and die? Why are some people good and some people bad? Why does it all work out the way it does? John's answer is, as Paul's answer is, it's all about him. He did it. He did it on purpose. He did it by himself, and he did it for himself. The answer to why is always because of him. You understand me? So why this week did Joshua and Julia have to go through the struggle they went through? It was a rough week for them. But as of last night, she was talking about how great God was in the middle of their problems. Now, she might have never grasped the greatness and the mercy of God with the same depth if she hadn't gone through the problem. The problem produced the opportunity to recognize the mercy of God in a bad situation. See, it doesn't matter what you're going through. If you're standing on the mountaintop with rainbows over your head and the bluebird of happiness up your nose, then that's God. He's given you a really good day. Say thank you. Other than the up your nose thing. If you're going through a struggle, if you're going through a trial, if you're going through a problem in your life, that's still God. It's still God doing his God thing. He is sitting on his throne doing whatever seems good to him, whatever pleases him. That's what he's in the enterprise of doing. And it all ends up glorifying him, and it all redounds to the glory of his Son. And if that's where God puts him, and if that's where John puts him, and if that's where Paul puts him, that should be a clue. We should also make sure that in our lives, in our attitude, in our religious thought, in our walk, in the way we treat people, in the way we raise our family, it should all be Christocentric. Where is Christ in this? What do you think of Christ in this? How are you representing Christ in this? What is your mind and heart where Christ is concerned in your circumstance right now? Now, the reason I had you go to the end of the book of John is because John actually closes this epistle, this gospel, by telling us this wonderful story about a conflict between Peter and John, and it has to do with this very idea, Christ at the center of your life. And I have taught whole sermons on just this little passage. It's a little late for that now. No, it's not too late.
Oh, no.
They're gonna stone you from the back row. You know the story that Peter three times denied Jesus. John includes that. We're going to read about it. Three times before Jesus' crucifixion, Peter denies him. After his resurrection, Peter and the others are out fishing, and they see the Lord on the seashore. Peter's the only one who just gets in the water and heads for shore. He can't wait for the boat to come in. The way that he knows who it is that they've been out there fishing all night, caught nothing. And from the shore he yells and says, "Children, do you have any meat? Have you caught any fish?" They say, "No, we've been at this all night. We got nothing." That's a paraphrase. And I don't know that that's the tone of voice they used. But in the Jim version, that was the attitude. And so he says, "Cast your nets out the other side." Now you got to figure, if they've been doing it all night, they've tried both sides. But he says, "Cast your nets out the other side." They throw the net out, and the net becomes so full that the boat lists off to one side, and they have to drag the net to the shore. That's how many fish they have. But when they get there, Jesus is sitting on the shore cooking fish. It's not about fish. It's about who's in charge. So he's sitting there cooking. Well, Peter realizes it's the Lord, and they have this wonderful conversation where after three times of denying the Lord, Jesus, after his resurrection, comes back to Peter exclusively and restores him three times. Gives him three opportunities to say he loves Jesus. So it's this wonderful story of restitution. At a time when Peter couldn't have gotten to Jesus, Jesus comes to Peter. And Jesus restores Peter. Well, after that, at the end of their conversation, Jesus said something that created a rumor that apparently lasted all the way until John's day when he wrote his gospel. And he feels like it's time now to squash that rumor. And the rumor is that John's not ever going to die. And he feels it's time, being a progressively older man, it's time to point out that that's not what Jesus said. Now, by the way, this is a great indication of the honesty of our author here. Because he wants to make sure that his audience understands the details of the relationship that he has with Jesus. And he doesn't create any flourishes, or he doesn't say, "I'm particularly great," or he does. Instead, what he says is this. Start verse 18. Jesus says to Peter, "Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wished to go. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you, and they will bring you where you do not wish to go." Of course, we know the story of Peter and his death. By best tradition, when he was crucified, he refused to be crucified right side up because he didn't feel that the honor of being crucified the way his Lord was something he should also participate in. He was crucified upside down. Now this he said, signifying what kind of death he would glorify God with. So he said this to Peter. I mean, he's just restored Peter. Do you love me? You know that I love you more than these. Do you love me? Okay, let me tell you something. Let me tell you about how you're going to die. You're going to die a painful death. You're going to die a martyr's death. And when he had spoken, he said to Peter, "Follow me." Now, how did Jesus begin his relationship with Peter? Do you remember? Peter's a fisherman. He's in there with John and James, sons of Zebedee. He's in there doing his fishing job. Jesus walks up and says two words to him. "Follow me." And it says they put down their nets, walked away from Zebedee's fishing enterprise, and they followed Jesus for the next 3.5 years. After Peter is restored here, Jesus again says to him, "Follow me. It's about me. I'm the center of it. Don't worry about all these other peripherals. Follow me." And then Peter, because he's Peter, Peter, because he consistently says the wrong thing, shoves his foot in his mouth repeatedly, Peter then turns around and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved. Now, throughout John's gospel, he never refers to himself by first name. But he names every other one of the disciples. So if the book were not written by John himself, then the author would have included John as one of the other disciples when he named them all. But the fact is, at this point in his life, his humility is such that he can't even bring himself to write his own name in relationship to Jesus. He just says that one that Jesus loved. Now, you want evidence that he's the one that Jesus loved? This is the guy who Jesus nicknamed a son of thunder. Because Jesus is sometimes funny. And that's okay. John and James listened to some of Jesus' critics, got real upset about it, came to Jesus and said, you know what we need to do with them? We need to call down fire from heaven and burn them up. That's what we need to do. And Jesus said, you don't know what kind of people you are. Do you understand why I'm here and what I'm here to do? And so from that point forward, he nicknamed them sons of thunder. This is a guy with some ego. James and John got their mother to go ask Jesus if in his kingdom they could have the two chairs on his immediate right and left. And they didn't have the nerve to ask themselves. They sent mom. Which is really funny when you put it in the Jewish context, too. Send the Jewish mother to go see what their sons can get, you know? So Mrs. Zebedee, we don't know her name, Mrs. Zebedee we're going with, goes to Jesus and says, in your kingdom, let my sons have the right and left. These are egocentric boys. And yet, despite that ego, despite that desire to just call down fire and burn people up, despite being that kind of headstrong man, he becomes known more than any of the other apostles as the apostle of love. Writes more about love than any of the other apostles. Something dramatic changed in this guy. Something dramatic happened in this guy's life that moved him from wanting to burn people and have the second seat in the kingdom to not even being willing to name his own name in his own gospel because he was just too humble to do it. Something changed. And what changed was he came in contact with the real, live, living, resurrected Lord. And it changed everything for him. The Holy Spirit of God took up residence in him, and it changed everything. So Peter turns around and sees John following them. And then to make sure we know it's John, he says, the one also who had leaned back on Jesus' breast at the Last Supper. Okay, now we know exactly who it is. It's John that's walking behind them. Verse 21, Peter therefore seeing him said to Jesus, Lord, and what about him? And what about this man? Okay, you've just told me I'm going to die a terrible death. When I get older, someone's going to gird me and take me somewhere I don't want to go, and I'm going to die a martyr's death. Okay, what about him? What about him? Now, what did Jesus just say to him? Follow me. Follow me. What does Peter immediately do? Look at somebody else. And go, well, what about him? How's he going to die? Is he going to die bad? I mean, if I got to die bad, shouldn't he have to die bad? He said, Lord, what about this man? And Jesus said to him, listen to me. Plant this in your brain. Tattoo this to your forehead so that you remember it every morning when you look in the mirror. Do not go home and tattoo this on your forehead. But Pastor Jim said, but burn this into your consciousness and your thinking. Jesus said, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. So much of our Christian life is spent looking horizontal, looking at other people. What about them, Lord? What about them? I'm working hard here, Lord. I'm serving you. I'm doing all the right stuff. And him, he gets a new car. I can't afford a new car. He's got a new car. He's no better than me. Why, Lord? Or, you know, I'm serving you. I'm doing fine, Lord. And I'm stricken again with some disease. I'm stricken again with some discomfort. I got to suffer again, Lord. Why? He's not suffering. He's doing fine. Look at him. And he's just barely nominally Christian, and I'm serving you, and look at me. The answer is always going to be every time you look at somebody else and try to draw a comparison between your Christianity and their Christianity, the answer is always, what is that to you? When did you become the central point here between what God is doing with Ron? God is working on Ron individually, specifically, personally, So whatever he's doing with Ron is what he's doing with Ron. But what he's doing with Kate might be something else. And so it's not fair for Kate to look at Ron and say, well, my Christianity's not going the way Ron's is going. The answer is, so? What is that to you? God will deal with you. God will deal with Ron. And as soon as you start that horizontal comparing thing, as soon as you start getting concerned about what everybody else is doing or somebody else is doing, you have moved Christ away from that central point he must have in every aspect of your life. And so Jesus said to Peter, what is it to you if I decide he's going to live till I come back? What is that to you? You follow me. See, your Christian relationship is a completely one-on-one relationship. And your relationship with Christ isn't supposed to look like somebody else's relationship with Christ. It's two different relationships. Okay, there's two young girls sitting here, one in a hat, one without. Okay? Both really cute, which is why I think there ought to be more young boys at GCA. I mean, they're missing a good bet here. I mean, you know, look around. There's cute girls in the back row here. There's some cute girls at GCA. Cute girl over there who's getting too cute too fast, so quit it. I said that for your father's sake. Shane, you owe me $20. Okay. Okay, so there's two cute girls here, one with a hat. Okay, now I have a relationship, a friendship with both of them. I'm getting to know Kate better as time goes by. Her in the hat, I know really, really well. Is it okay that my relationship with her is different than my relationship with her? Yeah. Does anybody have a problem with that? Yeah, because my relationship with my daughter is going to be very different than my relationship with somebody else's daughter. And we're all okay with that. And if I don't treat Kate the way I treat Megan, no one's going to blame me for that. Because it's two different relationships. If I buy Megan something, I don't have to buy Kate something. She's not my daughter.
She would like it, though.
I don't think there's any question about that.
Yeah.
Of course, it all kind of depends what it is I'm buying. So God is exactly the same. God has relationships with all his people, all his children, and in fact, all human beings. And he can treat Conrad with the kind of grace and mercy that will result in Conrad's everlasting life, forgiveness, glorification, perfect justification. Everything that Christ has purchased can be attributed to Conrad, and that's wonderful. But it doesn't obligate God to do that for anybody else. Just because he did it for Conrad doesn't mean he has to do it for anybody else. Thank God he's doing it for lots of people. But he's not under any obligation to do it for anybody because the relationship is up to him. Therefore, your relationship with him is personal. He picked you. He revealed himself to you. He drew you. I began today by telling you how it is that I came to Christianity. But I can't make that the standard. I can't say the way to be Christian is to be a long-haired, leather-wearing rock and roll boy until God knocks you over. I can't make that the standard. That's my circumstance. Your circumstances are going to be completely different because God deals with individuals. Whenever you get frustrated by what God is doing with somebody else, pull that phrase out again. What is that to you? Follow me. That is the essence of our Christian life and relationship. As a consequence, John writes in verse 23, this saying therefore went out among the brethren that that disciple John would not die. Because that's the way human beings work. Once they get a hold of, now Jesus posted a hypothetical over here. Jesus said, what is it to you if I let him live till I come back? So that begins the rumor mill. And next thing you know, John's immortal. John's not going to die. John's always going to be here. So he feels he needs to correct that misapprehension. This saying went out among the brethren that that disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die. He only said, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? That's all he actually said. So do you see the intrinsic honesty of the man here? He's saying, look, let me clear up what Jesus actually did say, even though the rumor about what he said pumps me up. John could have spent the rest of his life walking around saying, I'm John the Immortal. I am John the one that will never die. And he could have gotten plenty of people to follow him. Jesus himself, the resurrected Lord, said, I would not die. You know that people would flock to a guy like that. John didn't want that kind of credit. John couldn't help but put all of the emphasis back on Christ. So he finishes his letter by saying, look, squash the rumor. Jesus did not say I was not going to die. Jesus said, what is it to you if he stays here till I come? He created a hypothetical. And this is the disciple who bears witness of these things. John is now saying, I wrote this. I witnessed all this. Everything I wrote to you in this book, I was there. I saw it. I know it. I'm telling you the truth. I am an eyewitness. And where history is concerned, you can't get better veracity than an eyewitness. In court, that's what they love. Get an eyewitness. You bring in an eyewitness, that testimony has a tremendous amount of weight and bearing because the man is able to say, look, I saw it, I was there. And John is saying, I saw it, I was there, I'm telling you the truth. And then he closes with a really remarkable statement. He says, this is the disciple who bears witness of these things, and I wrote these things, and we know that his witness is true. And there are also many other things that Jesus did. That's interesting, because you've got the three synoptics, and then you've got John picking up after the synoptics and saying, let me add some more stuff you don't have. Let me tell you some more details you didn't know about. He's the only one that tells us about Jesus' high priestly prayer. That's important stuff. I'm glad John decided to give us the record of Jesus' high priestly prayer before he left the planet. That's really vital, important stuff in our understanding of Christ and who he is. So that's great. But then John says, now, by the way, I limited what I told you. In fact, I picked and chose particular things to tell you, and I had a reason for picking and choosing. He says, because if they had all been written in detail, then I suppose that even the world itself would not be able to contain the books that were written. In other words, in that 3.5 years, Jesus did so much stuff that we have no idea about. We've only got what the four gospel authors gave us. They gave us the stuff that was designed to help us believe. They gave us the stuff that was designed to shore up our faith. And they were very particular in what they chose. As we go through the gospel here of John, we're going to see that there's 7 miraculous signs that he chose. And so he's being very particular. He's being very exacting, almost like a lawyer pulling out his pieces of evidence rather than overwhelm the court with tons of stuff you can't wrap your head around. John's being real particular and saying, now look, I'm going to tell you about this and this and this and this, because the conclusion that I'm driving you to is Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah. He's God incarnate. And that's the point of my letter. You got all that? Okay, so then next week, we'll start at John 1:1. And we'll actually begin, well, I've quoted it a couple times, but next week we'll push our way into the contrast between life and death, darkness and light. Because John starts right there. John starts right out creating splits in humanity and saying there's dark and there's light and there's life and there's death, and it all revolves around Jesus. He's going to put Jesus right at the center of every man's eternal destiny. And if that's where John puts him, if that's where Paul puts him, if that's where God puts him, then we got to remember to put him there too. Yes?
Yes.
If John had let that rumor persist, then his witness of who Christ was would have been totally ruined.
Absolutely. Yes, when he died, wouldn't that have wrecked everything he said about Christ? Sure. Would have been a big disappointment to his followers, too. All right. Questions? That was just the introduction. All that was introduction. Technically doesn't count against my time, but we'll pick up my time again next week.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.